durch die Brille gefragt. Der Podcast von und mit Heinz-Rudolf Kunze. Herzlich willkommen, liebe Leute, zu einer weiteren Folge von Durch die Brille gefragt mit Heinz-Rudolf Kunze. Ich habe heute einen Gast, nein, genauer gesagt, ich habe sogar zwei Gäste, denn der zweite Gast hat dieses Gespräch mit dem Gast Nummer 1 vermittelt, weil er ihn seit vielen Jahren kennt. Das ist mein alter Freund Peter Badke, ein profilierter Fotograf, der in Berlin lebt. Und Peter kennt durch seine Arbeit die unglaublichsten Menschen auf der Welt. Ich werde auch gleich mal fragen, wie es zu dieser Bekanntschaft hier kam, die mir heute gegenüber sitzt. Das ist auch schon lange her. Peter und ich kennen uns bestimmt schon 15 Jahre und auf eine andere, bestimmt noch abenteuerlichere Weise hat er meinen heutigen Gast kennengelernt. Es ist ein berühmter Bassist, einer der Crème de la Crème dieses Instruments auf dieser Welt. Er kommt aus Kalifornien, hat deutsche Wurzeln und bis vor kurzem hätte ich gesagt, er sei der einzige Mensch auf der Welt, der mit zwei Elvisen gespielt hat. Das stimmt aber, glaube ich, nicht ganz, denn er hat mit Elvis Presley und Elvis Costello gespielt, aber ich glaube, James Burton hat auch mit Elvis Presley und Elvis Costello gespielt, wenn ich mich richtig an das Album King of America erinnere. Herzlich willkommen, Jerry Scheff.
Hello, thank you very much.
Ich werde natürlich, damit ihr wisst, worum es hier geht, meine Fragen auf Englisch und auf Deutsch stellen. Jerry Scheff wird aber ganz relaxed und in aller Ruhe auf Amerikanisch-Englisch antworten. So, meine erste Frage war, als ich dieses Buch von Jerry Scheff, die Autobiografie, gelesen habe, was er genau mit dem Titel meint. Way Down heißt dieses Buch und das kann ja im Englischen als Redensart, als Phrase alles Mögliche bedeuten. Was hat er sich bei dem Titel gedacht? Your book is called Way Down. And Way Down, I think, can have a multitude of meanings. So what did you have in mind when you called your book Way Down? Did you mean the low notes on the bass, or what did you mean?
No, there is a song that we recorded with Elvis called Way Down. And it was one of the last albums that I played with him, that we all played with him on. And I didn't have a title for my book. And the publishing company made the suggestion that they thought Way Down would be a good title for the book. So I said, why not? And so that's...
And how would you explain Way Down to a German reader? What does Way Down mean in your interpretation?
Well, the Way Down is the last... notes in the song on the record are way down. And that's the best way to describe it. Yeah.
My second question, I was very curious about that. Why did you choose, as an elder statesman of bass, to live in Berlin right now? Why did you leave America for Europe, and why especially Berlin?
Well, it's a long story.
We've got the time.
In the late 90s, I was living in America, but I was working mostly in Europe and in the United Kingdom. And I met a Scottish woman who in Vienna, Austria, and she was there playing French horn with the Vienna Philharmonic. And we kept in touch. And so eventually, after about a year, I decided we had communicated and talked, and I decided to move to Scotland. So I moved to Scotland, and another year went by, and she and I got married. And I lived there for 15 years. And unfortunately, the marriage ended in a very unhappy situation, and I won't go into that, but I needed to leave Scotland. So I moved to Sweden. I had a friend in Sweden, Peter Badge, who is responsible for me being here, actually, in Berlin.
Hab es mir doch gedacht.
He probably, if I had said to him, I need to leave, where should I go? He would have said, move to Berlin, you know. But I had another friend in Sweden that I had known for years. And so I decided to go to Sweden. So I moved to Sweden. This was about 2.5 years ago. And I lived in Sweden for 2 years, and it was a beautiful place and a lovely society, but for an old bass player like me, it was sort of a dead end, you know? So I decided I had to leave there. And Peter Badge was going to Iceland to do a presentation of his photographs. You'll have to explain who Peter is if people don't know who he is.
I've done it already, yes.
Yeah, and so I went up to Iceland and we discussed my moving to meet with Peter, and we decided I would move to Berlin, and just a few months later, I moved here.
Also ist es tatsächlich so, dass du ganz lange schon nicht mehr in deiner Heimat gelebt hast. So, as a matter of fact, you're an expatriate for a long time now, right?
Here in Berlin?
No, I mean outside of America.
Oh, yeah. And I have absolutely no desire to go back to the United States now.
How come? Wie kann das sein, dass er keinen Wunsch hat, in seiner Heimat zu leben?
5 simple letters. T-R-U-M-P. Do I need to say more? I don't want to get into this, but I'm afraid that the United States is right on the verge of being a complete mess and is going to wind up in... I think there's going to be some really hard times there. And so I will go back probably maybe next year if they let me into the United States, if I can get back into Germany after visiting there, because you can't go from America to Germany now, or to anywhere in the EU. You can't go from the America there. So I will go visit my grandchildren when I have a chance, and my sister and two nephews and. And I like it here. I'll stay here and I'm happy.
Ich muss versuchen, einmal nachzufragen, auch wenn Jerry Sheff eben angedeutet hat, dass ihm dieses Thema nicht so willkommen ist. Aber wann hat man schon mal die Gelegenheit, einen Menschen zu fragen, der von da stammt? Let me just have one try. I heard that that you don't want to get into it, but we don't have so many opportunities to ask American people how this all could happen over there. This phenomenon, Trump. Do you have an explanation for that? For us, it's a big enigma. We think, how could this happen?
Do you have an hour? 2 hours, maybe?
No. Just go on.
I'll try and keep it short. I was born in 1941. Okay? I grew up in San Francisco area of California, and after World War II was over, the soldiers were coming back from the Orient and from Europe, and the United States government took really good care of the soldiers and the sailors and the people who had been gone and involved in that. And they provided, everything just about. And for other people in the United States. And it was the start of a sort of a golden age in the United States. It was the American dream was very possible. You know what the American dream is supposed to be. Do you know what that is? The American dream is that anybody
can make it.
As long as they wanted to go for it, they could make it.
Yeah. You see, my brother is a professor for history in Germany. And he said the first short period after World War II, everybody in the world, if he wasn't mad, wanted to be an American.
Yeah, because everything was so good there for everybody. So the years passed, and Ronald Reagan became president of the United States, and he was the first president that was really owned by the corporate interests in America.
What about Richard Nixon?
He was owned by them. They owned him. He was the first one. He was governor of California, and he turned all of the people out of mental health hospitals in California, saying that they should have their choice of whether to be in there or not. Well, and people wonder where the homeless people come from in the United States. What can I say? You know, that's where many of the homeless people came from in California. So then Richard Nixon was another one. And I don't think he was quite as owned by the corporates, but he was. Then, if you come up to George W. Bush, he was completely owned by the corporations. And now the corporations own the United States, and they own Donald Trump, and it's legal for Trump to appoint court judges, federal judges, and Supreme Court judges who he wants and who are owned by corporations.
Yeah.
So what this all means is that we're right on the edge of the United States of being how do you pronounce it? Oligarch. So a country owned by the wealthy, and that's what the United States is now. The American dream is dead, and we have certain people in the United States that are everything is guides them politically is by race, and racial discrimination all the way from the slavery in the United States. We have a whole portion of the United States where even the religious evangelics from the South and Midwest in the United States are they back Donald Trump.
Ja, ja. Aber, sorry, wir haben uns hier immer gefragt in Deutschland, oder viele fragen sich das, wie konnte dieser Unfall, dieser größte anzunehmende Unfall Trump passieren? Es gibt doch eine politische Klasse in den USA von intelligenten, hochintelligenten Menschen, die imstande hätten sein müssen, das zu verhindern. We keep asking us here, there is a political class in the USA, a very bright, very intelligent people. How could it happen that they were not able to prevent such a monster to get elected?
It wasn't just the people from the South and the Midwest, and it wasn't just the people who didn't have any educations didn't have any. It was also people who, because of racism, they like Donald Trump. Then you have the people who benefit financially from the corporate, the owners of the corporations, the shareholders in the corporations. So it isn't just people who aren't intelligent. It's people who they keep their mouths shut because they're going to get a lot of money into their pockets and their bank accounts. So, you understand?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Jerry Sheff hat gesagt, der amerikanische Traum sei vorbei. Dann kommen wir doch mal zu dem Teil des amerikanischen Traums zurück oder darauf zu sprechen, der uns jetzt hier eigentlich als Musiker am ehesten angeht. You said the American dream is over.
It's over. It's gone.
In rock and roll too?
Right after World War II ended, when all the soldiers and the sailors and the people came home, the United States, the American dream was alive. The government backed loans for people. In fact, it was still the place. I was in the United States Navy in the late 1950s, and I was able to get a real low interest loan on the first house that I bought in the United States because of that same law. And that's no longer a case.
No, I mean, ich meine, ob der amerikanische Traum auch beendet ist, was die Musik anbetrifft. I mean, what became of the American dream in terms of rock music? Is rock music over too?
One more time.
What became of the American dream in terms of rock music? Is rock music over too?
World music?
Yeah, rock music.
Oh, no, you know, the culture, and black people in the United States have a separate culture, you know, and people don't understand that, you know, most white people in the United States don't understand that, and they make jokes about names that black people give their children. They make jokes about rap music. They don't know what it is, you know. And they make, so it's a different culture, you know. And now there's a whole uprising against black discrimination. And fortunately, that's one thing that's taking hold in the United States. I think it's going to stay there regardless of whether the rich own it or not, you know. This new move about Black Lives Matter, you know. And the racists in the United States like to say, well, all lives matter, you know. And so,
which is true, of course.
Well, it's true, but on the other hand, these people are descendants, the black people in the United States are descendants of these people who are uprooted from their societies, separated from their families, separated from their children, beaten, worked in the fields, and these are the descendants of those people. And the racism that came out of slavery took hold in the early 1900s. They called it Jim Crow laws, and the South passed all these laws that discriminated against black people. They had, so the black people, all they're saying is that because we've been held down under your thumbs all of these years, which is true, we need some help with our lives to make them matter again. And your lives matter, everybody's lives, but we need help because of where we came from in this country. So that's, is that a good explanation?
Yeah. You know, I'm not an expert in rap music and hip-hop music, but as far as I perceive white rock music in America or in England, it seems to be in some sort of crisis. It seems to be a bit dried up, I think.
Okay, I'll get off on another lecture here.
Yes, please.
No, there's a more complicated answer to what you're asking. White music in America became its own thing. I didn't like white music. And this is talk about when I first met Elvis and I lived with him. I won't get into all that, but it's in the book. But But I grew up listening to black radio stations from the time I was 12 years old in the San Francisco area, because so many workers in World War II moved out there for the work in the shipyards, and that's what my family moved out there for. But the black people, there were so many black people that they had their own radio stations, and I used to go to bed because my older brother liked black music. He's 6 years older than I was, and so I'd go to bed listening to that. So years later, when I moved, I started playing in clubs when I was about 15. I started playing in jazz clubs, black jazz clubs, in San Francisco when I was 15. And I started knowing these people as people, not as black people, but as people. And years after that, I went to Los Angeles and I became a studio musician. And played on other people's records and motion picture soundtracks. And
you didn't like any of the white stuff?
I hated it. Elvis Presley, when I was in high school, when I was 16 and 17 years old, I had been immersed in black music. And they would have in our where we ate lunch, a cafeteria in my high school, they had a jukebox, you know, and they'd play Elvis Presley in it. And I used to hear that and I thought, God, how can these people like that shit? You know? And really, because I thought he was a white guy trying to sound black, you know. So when I became a studio musician in Los Angeles, I got a phone call one day, and it was James Burton, and I didn't remember who he was. I had only worked with him once or twice, and he said, we're putting a band together for Elvis Presley to go into Las Vegas. This was in 1968, and he said, we want to come down and play with us, you know, and join the band. And I put my hand over the receiver and I said to my wife, I said, you're not going to believe this, but they want me to come down and play with Elvis Presley
tomorrow. Tough luck.
And she said, oh, you're kidding. She didn't like him either.
Ich war immer sehr erstaunt, wenn ich gehört habe, wie viele...
Let me just continue with this just a minute. So I went down just to see what he was like, you know. And when I walked away from that rehearsal, I was a fan of Elvis Presley.
I read it, yes.
Yeah, so that's sort of... My wife, I said, you're not going to believe this, but I'm going to go to work with him. And she said, you're not. And I said, yeah. I said, you come down tomorrow and listen to him and meet him. And she did, and she walked out of there. She was an Elvis Presley fan. So I was learning, now I want to connect this with your question about white music. So I was learning a whole new specter of American music that I had no idea existed, that I hated. And that was my introduction to American white music. And today, people listen to music for two reasons, or more than two reasons, but two reasons. They look back on their lives and they listen, like to listen to the music that they danced with their girlfriends when they were in school. And it's all nostalgia, you know, gives them feelings of what they had back then. Other people, myself included, listen to music searching for the Holy Grail, what's different today, you know, that's what I listen to. I comb the internet and listen to world music. So there's white music, is American white music, it's rock and roll, it's alive, you know.
Darf ich was fragen?
Okay, now you can go on.
Yeah. Ich möchte fragen, ob er dann wirklich der Meinung ist, dass alle weißen Künstler im Grunde genommen nur schwarze Vorbilder imitieren, haben die gar nichts Eigenes anzubieten. Und dann möchte ich nochmal zu dem Status von Elvis kommen, weil es da, glaube ich, schon Generationsunterschiede gibt. So would you say that from your point of view, all white artists are just trying to imitate black artists? Don't they have anything to offer which is their own thing?
Well, no, that's not true, you know, because, but even in, like, for instance, in American country music, Bill Monroe, who was, he sort of invented bluegrass music, which is fiddle and banjo and stuff, you know. He got that from the Scotch-Irish people who moved to the United States from Ireland and Scotland, Celtic music. And so in Celtic music, if you listen to, like, I lived in Scotland for 15 years and I grew to love Celtic music, and it's soul music as much as American black music is. It's just a different language, but it's soul music.
You listen. That's why Van Morrison is a soul singer.
Yeah, and so Bill Monroe invented this in the United States, called it bluegrass. Yeah, it was wonderful, wonderful. And so American white music, country music, is inundated with American, Scottish, Irish imports that came from Europe and or from the UK, and from by black music. Bill Monroe, this man who invented bluegrass music, listened to black. He says in his interviews that he listened to black music, and so when he's playing his singing and his you know, and stuff. But it's got a soul kind of a twinge to it, you know, and you can tell that he's been listening to soul music, you know, and soul music. I was in Sweden and I listened to the Sami, what's it called, Jolka music, which is the Sami music of the reindeer herders, you know. It's soul music. I mean, you listen to that and it's as much as black music is. So it's all over the world, soul music, and that's never going to die out. It's not going to die out in the United States. Not going to, country music's not, there are a lot of people that imitate, I coined a phrase, country musician, modern country musicians are like white people impersonating white people, and a lot of black singers now are black people impersonating black people, but rap music is a whole other story. I don't know if you want to get into that or not, but I enjoy rap music very much, but for a different reason, not for the soul part of it. But
and for what reason?
I enjoy it because for literary reasons. People don't understand that rap music is poetry. And some of
it. Is it really? Because
it is.
I get the impression they're all just swearing all the time.
It's pure poetry. Real rap music is. Mm-hmm. You have the impersonators that impersonate rap music, and it's bullshit. You know? but real rap music. I have a friend in New Jersey who produces hip hop music. You know, as he does, and we communicate all the time. And he turned me on to this, and he sends me real literary quality rap lyrics.
Can you mention a name, an artist I could know?
Well, I can't, not offhand right now. I would have to, I can send them to you though, on by email. And sure enough, you know, some of them they're like reading, the literary value of them is amazing. And so, but there again, you have to understand black culture to really get the meaning of the whole thing. If you don't understand American black culture, it's going to be like Martian music to you, you know, which it is to most people. Like, musicians say, I hate rap music, you know. So anyhow.
Well, I think it's quite successful over here.
Oh, yeah, everybody loves it. And people, white people are all using black slang constantly. The kids use black slang, you know. Yeah, are you feeling me? You know, and that's black slang. That started in the streets in the United States. And these guys would say, are you like, you understand my heart? Are you feeling me? You know, and kids all over the world now are saying that. I see it online all the time, you know. Cool, the word cool.
Yeah, of course.
Well, cool, when I was working black clubs when I was 15, that was used then. But cool meant, if you understood and weren't a racist, you were considered cool. And that, and if you were black and you were considered cool, you weren't a racist, but you were somebody who knew what was going on in the world as far as in the United States as far as blacks are concerned. That's where cool came from, you know. So much of that stuff. So how many people use that now? I mean,
everybody. And it means everything.
Yeah.
If you grew up, as you wrote in your book, in the Bay Area, what are your memories? Forgive me, but this is my interest. What are your memories in bands like The Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane and Quicksilver Messenger Service, the psychedelic explosion?
Let me have that one.
What are your memories about that?
Huh?
What are your memories about those bands?
About what, psychedelic bands?
Yeah. Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Moby Grape.
Some of them are brilliant, you know. I played on some of that stuff, you know, as a studio musician. There was a group called Sky Saxon and the Seeds.
Yes, I heard the name, yes.
Well, I worked on their album. You know, I played on You're Pushing Too Hard. The main lyric on that, you're pushing too hard, you're pushing too hard, you're pushing too hard. But I didn't know what it was, you know. I just, okay, you know, it sounds like a bass part will fit with that. And that's what I did, you know.
Because those bands in 1965, 1966,
you know,
and they did a new thing that
Moby
was not Grape, known here.
Moby Grape, it was really good. There are many of them. I listened to some of that stuff, and it's just if you want to hear some of that stuff, if we get together on email, I'll send you some things from back then that are just so, they're so good, you won't believe it, you know.
For us, it was impressive because it was very different from the English stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Very different.
Yeah. I see there again, you know, I mean, the English bands, well, I think, like the Rolling Stones, were probably the first English band that I really liked, you know. And I liked them because I didn't know that they originally started out with their little Beatle haircuts, and they weren't quite the rebels that they became later, you know. But I liked that rebellious thing in them. I've always been a fan of that, you know. I'm a fan of some. What's it called? Punk music.
Yeah.
You know? Because, you know, you had all these bands, British bands mostly, orchestras. They called themselves orchestras. And you had albums came out like The Wall. You know that album? It was, I can't remember the name of the band.
Pink Anyhow. Floyd.
Huh?
The Wall, Pink Floyd?
Yeah. Yeah, Pink Floyd. You had all this stuff, and kids sitting in their garages, in their rooms, with just a guitar, they can't relate to all of that, you know? They needed some music that they could play in their bedrooms and in their garages, you know? And all of a sudden, punk music came, and that's what it was.
Well, but there was an alternative. They could... admire the good stuff and learn.
I'm sorry, what?
They could admire the good stuff and then learn and improve.
Well, sure, you know, but the basic thing is they can relate to it, you know. And so I appreciate punk music for that reason. You know, and some of it, like you say, some of them improved on it first, and it was, came out with like the Ramones and those people. They came out with some really good stuff, you know.
I read one name, ich habe einen Namen in deiner Biografie gelesen, da musst du mir was erklären, das konnte ich gar nicht fassen. I was very astonished. You worked with Leonard Nimoy. I never knew that he was making music.
You know, when you're a studio musician, you get called and it's like going to the factory.
You know. And what did he do? I never knew he was making music.
Well, when you do studio music, people call. Like we had when I was at my busiest in Los Angeles, we had answering services, phone answering service, and it was just for musicians. And if somebody wanted to book us for a session, they would call a producer. They would call the answering service and say, is Jerry available for this and this and this? Yep. And the answering service would say yes or no. And they would keep your book. The answering service would keep your book. And sometimes you would get calls and you'd have three-hour sessions was a record date, 3 hours. You'd have four of those in a day. So you couldn't pack up your instruments and drive all the way across Los Angeles, which is much bigger than Berlin, and area-wise, and drive across it and set all your stuff up. So we had cartage services, which would have your setup, you know, four of them, or, you know, and they would be setting your things up when you're finished. That's how much of a factory it was. And a lot of times you had no idea who you were going to play for. So Leonard Nimoy, I walked into a recording studio, and there's Leonard Nimoy.
And what's he trying to do, country and western or what?
No, he just sort of, I can't even remember what it was. I haven't listened to it since I did it. But there he was, you know, and of course I knew who he was, you know. And he played, we did this album, and, you know, they had arrangements, and in this case it was, everything was written. And so I just sat there and read parts and bass parts, you know, off of this thing. And that was, I put my bass in the case and sat it down and left, you know, and went to the next studio.
You said in your book that playing with Elvis was like going to school for you. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well, we discussed that earlier, you and I, when I told you when I went down and I became a fan of his. I suddenly knew that there was a good side to American white music, you know. And over a period of time, I learned to appreciate, like, some country music, you know. You know, Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson Johnny Cash. And I learned what was good about it, you know. And it just opened my brain up. You know, it was wonderful because I had a whole side of music that I had listened to. Clyde played in orchestras, tuba and bass violin, symphonies, not junior symphonies when I was a teenager, you know. And so I had classical music I knew, and I knew American black jazz, but I was such a bigot about jazz that I didn't like American West Coast jazz because it wasn't funky enough for me, even though some black people were playing it, you know? And I learned over the years to love a lot of that too, you know. So I've sort of grown into music. That's what my book is about. My book is about my life in the music business. It's not really an autobiography, you know, but it's about how music... I was a 12-year-old bigot walking around my neighborhood, which was all white, you know, with other kids, spewing out all of these racist, you know, jungle bunnies and niggers and stuff, you know. And but when I, as I grew older, I learned, you know, I learned all this stuff, and it's continued my whole life.
Es scheint ein ungeschriebenes Gesetz zu geben. Jedenfalls ist mir das immer wieder passiert. Ganz viele herausragende Musiker, die man trifft, haben eine heimliche Liebe, und das scheint irgendwie Jazz zu sein. Und ich glaube, das gilt hier auch. There seems to be an unwritten law. Most famous musicians I've ever met have a secret love, and that is jazz. Is that true for you too?
It depends on the kind of jazz, you know. There was a time when if it didn't have a blues background to it, I didn't like it, even though it was jazz, you know. And European jazz, I thought was, you know, that's soulless, you know. And so I was very bigoted about what I liked, you know. And but over the years, I've listened to, I haven't had time yet. Usually where I live, I start listening to the music of the country I'm living in, because I've lived in so many countries, you know. And in Sweden, boy, there are some jazz players, and they have no blues, really soul kind of feel in the music. But I heard some jazz music in Sweden that was just marvelous, you know. It was same in the UK, you know. Later on, I started listening to it, you know. And so, yeah, it's so jazz isn't necessarily a secret love for me.
Okay. Did you ever regret being a sideman? Did you ever wanted to be a solo star?
No, I never really wanted to be a front person, you know.
Why not?
Because we're in a long story. Okay. The way that I approach bass playing is it's a little different than there's two ways you can approach things. And my approach to playing bass is to play what I want to play. I listen to the song, the lyrics, the vocal. That's the starting place to what I'm going to play in a song. I don't listen to the drummer.
No?
No, because if I'm listening to the drummer, then I'm getting in the way of letting things flow through.
This is interesting.
From the music. So if you think of it as music and not rhythm, only, yeah, then stuff comes through your brain, you know. I don't know where it comes from, but it comes. So that's how I play bass on songs. You can play bass where there are people who, and this is a very, I'm not putting this way down, there are people who need the bass to melt into the background behind them, so that, and not interfere with their thing, you know, their singing. I played with Tom Petty one time, went in the studio and played with him.
Oh, I'm a fan, I'm a huge fan.
And he's the first song that we did, he said we were started the song, and he was in a booth, and he said, he stopped the whole thing. He said, "Jerry, what's that note?" And I said, "Well, I said, that's the way I play, Tom." And I said, you know, I will listen to it on the playback, and if it fits, you know, if it doesn't, I'll know not to do it, you know. And he said, well, I don't like it. And I said, well, I like it for now. And so that was, I didn't fit. He wanted the bass to melt into the thing, you know. And that's, he was that way, a lot of artists are that way, you know. And so so that's, I didn't want to be a front man because, well, for one thing, I didn't think I was a good singer, you know, and a good enough singer to be. And I didn't, I've never been, I don't like posing on stage, you know. I don't like doing wind-ups and jumping all over and getting in each other's face like, well, look at how hard we're rocking, you know. I don't like that kind of stuff. If you look at any of the Elvis shows that are you see on YouTube and stuff, and you see me back there, I'm not posing on any of it, you know. And so that's another reason why I didn't want to be a front man. But later on, I got thinking, and unfortunately my hearing was going. A long time ago it started going. And by the time I thought that maybe I could sing well enough, my hearing was going. But now, if I'm recording at home, and I have these hearing aids I have now, I can sing again. So I'm singing some stuff on things I'm recording, songs I'm writing and stuff, you know. So maybe I'll be an 80-year-old front man, you know.
Why not? Ich muss aus persönlicher Neugier zu zwei Künstlern kommen, weil sie mich einfach so faszinieren. Alles kann man gar nicht erwähnen. Die Diskografie von Jerry Sheff ist seitenlang. Also es sind hunderte von Alben, auf denen er gespielt hat. Aber zwei Dinge muss ich ansprechen. I think my favorite American band of all time is The Doors. And you almost joined them. You wrote, you were on the verge of joining them.
I was asked to join them, yeah.
And would you have stayed for longer?
I would have joined them.
Yes, but it didn't come to a tour because Jim died.
Well, no, well, what happened was is that I got called to do that album as a studio musician, once again, you know. Except they booked a couple of weeks of time in the studio. And the man who engineered most of the Doors records was producing a record at A&M Records, an album that I was playing bass on. And
Bruce Botnick.
Yeah. And Bruce knew of me from the Elvis things, you know, stuff. But we were doing an entirely different thing. It was a white blues singer from Texas. And so... He was talking, they were talking, the producer of the Doors albums that had produced most of their albums didn't like the material that they had. They didn't like L.A. Woman and Riders on the Storm. And which
how was, wrong they were.
Oh, how wrong he was, you know. And I knew him, I had worked with him, not something else. But he said it sounded like elevator music to him. Really, that's what he said. So Bruce Botnick and the Doors got together and they decided to record this album. And evidently, Jim Morrison and someone else had come to one of the big screen, we were doing these big screen shows, Elvis on screens and stuff, way after he died. And Morrison made a comment about the bass playing. So Botnick had heard that, and so he said they were talking about getting a bass player, and Botnick said, well, how about Jerry Sheff? I'm working with him right now. And they all said, oh, yeah, you know, let's get him. So they hired me for that. So we finished the album, and they asked me to join. Band and I went to Elektra Records with them. This is before Jim Morrison went to Paris and died. I went to Elektra Records and to a meeting there. And so it was set I was going to get a piece of the Doors. And I wouldn't have left Elvis unless they were going to give me a piece of the Doors, you know. And and then Morrison went off to Paris and died. And I never ever heard the rest of the Doors. I worked with them. I did a Ray Manzarek album with him and so forth. But I never heard them talk about me being offered a piece of the Doors. And I think they were afraid that I would come back at them and try and legally score a piece of that of the L.A. Woman album, you know, which I never would have done if I could have, and I, you know, wouldn't have done it. But so that was how that whole thing ended.
It was such a funny combination because I think it must have been the only band in the world without a bass player.
Yeah. Well, they used bass on
in the studio, yes, of course,
one or two of their albums, but. It was to copy what Ray was playing on his. They wanted more of the grit.
Yeah, of course, and they needed it badly.
Yeah, and you know, Larry Nechtel. Do you know who he is? Larry Nechtel is a really good friend of mine, and Larry was hired to play bass on one of their albums, and here that he was. A brilliant bass player, and of course, a brilliant piano player. He played piano on and wrote and played piano on Simon and Garfunkel's "Bridge Over Troubled Water." So he used to tell you what a brilliant piano player he was.
But he played that. Wow.
Exactly. And it took him. He told me it took him 3 days. He went home and arranged that song in 3 days, and. But they hired him, and they wouldn't let him play like they did me. They wouldn't let him play. They made him copy Ray, you know, and which was a shame. But with me, we tried one song. I think it was L.A. Woman. With me listening to what Ray was playing on it, and everybody stopped the tape and said, "Jerry, play what you want to play." And so I did the whole album. And there are some of the lines, there's a few lines, let me just get this straight, to Ray's in talking about his brilliance. You know. There are some of the lines, the line on Riders on the Storm, da-doo-doo-doo, da-doo-doo-doo, those notes, those exact notes were from him.
Yeah.
And I hate it when people say, "God, that Riders on the Storm, that bass part's really great." And I have to say, well, you know, Ray. But the other notes are all mine.
I don't want to ask you too many personal things about your singers, but in one case, I'm really curious because I'm such a fan. Can you tell me, without being indiscreet, a little bit of what was Bob Dylan like?
Bob Dylan?
Yes. What was he like?
A specific day in mind?
No. His character, his way of communicating with other people.
If you read the book, you know. Bob, what can I say? You know, I mean, they told me I wasn't going to go down and play with him there again, you know. I was doing an album with Tanya Tucker at the time. I was a leader on the album, and she country singer and impersonating a white person. And anyhow, they wanted me to come down and play, and I was booked up for weeks, you know. And finally, Steve Douglas, who's really well-known saxophone player, and he called me up. He said, Jerry, you got to get your ass down here. You know? Okay. So I said, okay. So I went down to Bob and played and for a little while, and everybody in the band agreed, and he agreed that I had the gig, the job.
And how many albums were you on?
Oh, just one.
Street Legal.
Street Legal, yeah. And
very good album, by the way.
What?
A very good album, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty good, you know. It sort of got, you know, it got panned by the critics because nobody, he was trying to reinvent himself again, and he was very smart to do that, you know. The greats always trying to reinvent themselves. Elvis did when he hired us for his band, instead of having the Ricky Tiki rockabilly thing, you know. And so, yeah, he was trying to reinvent himself. And everybody told me we were going to fly to the UK to open up, to rehearse. And everybody told me, don't talk to Bob. He doesn't like small talk, you know. So I said, well, that's cool, you know. So we got on the plane, we were flying first class. And here's Bob sitting next to me, L.A. to London. And all of a sudden, he started talking to me. And he was going through his thing about breaking up in his marriage and his kids. And he knew that I had gone through that. And he asked my opinion. We wound up talking all the way to London about that, you know. And I hung out with him a lot in London, you know. So it was, he was cool in that way, you know. But he was hard on people. He was real hard on drummers, you know. But I think the reason that was he wanted to keep reinventing himself. His new album that he has now out is a reinvention of himself. Of course, his voice isn't the same now.
No.
But it doesn't make any difference. I mean, look at him. Yeah. And so I think that his whole approach to music from the time that I went to play with him was he was looking for different ways. He'd sing his songs completely different. He'd start his tambourine man. He started a completely different key and a different tempo and different approach to it altogether. You had to really, really listen to him. Yeah, because he just, even on stage, he just kept looking for things, you know. And I loved that. I really enjoyed that, you know. It keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Was hatte ich jetzt noch? Zwei Fragen hatte ich noch. Ja, natürlich, die Frage, die man stellen muss, wenn man einem alten Fahrensmann gegenüber sitzt, der so viel gemacht hat. Gibt es irgendwas oder irgendwelche Künstler, mit denen er gerne gespielt hätte, zu denen es nie kam? Und die andere Frage natürlich im Anschluss logisch, ob es tatsächlich im fortgeschrittenen Alter für einen gestandenen Profi wie ihn immer noch musikalische Träume gibt zu verwirklichen. Was there some artist you would have liked to play with but never could?
Oh, sure.
And who was that, for instance?
Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh, I agree. I understand.
Stravinsky. No, I was Miles Davis. I mean, I could go. The list is. I always say, well, I was going to play with them, but they never called me.
But many did. Many did.
Yeah, but Miles Davis, I first heard in Washington D.C. when I was 17 years old, and he had just put out, had gone to the Modal. His kind of blue type band, John Coltrane. I heard that band in person in Washington, D.C. So I knew the piano player that I was studying musical theory in school at that time. had grown up with Bill Evans, who's the piano player playing with Miles, and so we went down to the club and I got a chance to hang out a little bit. You know, I never met Miles, I never said anything to anybody. I was scared to death, you know, but I was there. And then later, went to San Diego and joined a jazz group in San Diego that we started playing those same songs. And this was in 1959. We started playing those same songs. And then I opened with a folk singer. Well, actually, that Texas blues singer I'm talking about, in a East Coast college concert, opening for Miles Davis in this college. And I got to hear Miles there. I didn't get to talk to anybody. So Miles was always, out of all the people, I think probably he's the one.
And apart from the guys who have gone, are there still unfulfilled dreams, what you would like to do in the future?
Oh,
yeah. As a bass player, as a musician, yes?
Yeah. I think that I read something recently, and it really made sense. It was about a man who survived World War II, and he started a whole new psychological trend on how to survive and grow old in a meaningful way. And he's very famous now. I can't remember his name, unfortunately. But having a purpose of something to accomplish is, you have to have that. If you live in the past all the time and you have no goals in life, no matter how old you are, you die younger. And I believe that completely. So yeah, I have, I'm writing songs, and it even extends to, I write a lot of electronic music, sort of combination music and stuff. I don't care if anybody ever hears it. My joy comes from looking for something that doesn't sound like anybody has done before. And to look for that, it's like the quest for the Holy Grail, you know. That's one of my purposes. And the other is that I need to have some hip surgery. And when I finish that, I'm going to go back out and start playing. I did some concerts in Denmark just before I moved here from Sweden. That's only 6-7 months ago, you know. But I will go out and do some playing, and I'm doing recording. I just got a email today from an old guy, a guy I used to play with in Los Angeles, do sessions with in Los Angeles, and I'm going to put bass parts on his. But I sit in my house and do it. They ship me the tracks over the cloud, these enormous thing, and I download them right into my computer, and I sit and I just like I'm sitting in a recording studio with the tracks, and I can turn this up and turn it down, and I sit and put bass parts on and send it back to them, and they may say, oh, could you do this a little different? And they send it back to me, and I fix that until we have it fixed. And that's what I'm doing. So those are all goals, you know, that I have.
Das ist schön. Ein Mann, der Ziele hat, auch im fortgeschrittenen Alter und der seinen Holy Grail als Musiker immer noch sucht. Da kann man wenig hinzufügen. Es ist eine großartige Begegnung, mit einem so gestandenen Bassmannsbild zusammen gewesen sein zu dürfen. Vielen Dank. Thank you very much, Jerry Schaff.
Oh,
for your lectures, for your insights.
It was my pressure.
Vielen Dank und bis zum nächsten Mal, liebe Freunde. Tschüss.